Welcome to Louisiana Lefty, a podcast about politics and community in Louisiana, where we make the case that the health of the state requires a strong progressive movement fueled by the critical work of organizing on the ground. Our goal is to democratize information, demystify party politics, and empower you to join the mission, because victory for Louisiana requires you. I'm your host, Linda Woolard. On this episode, I'm taking a point of personal privilege. My father, Ed Woolard, passed away last week. When I first started Louisiana Lefty, and as the country was still incapacitated by COVID, I interviewed him to talk about bipartisanship. Ed was a conservative Republican. I'm a liberal Democrat, but we had many a productive conversation about politics. He would often ask me how my sister and I ended up as Democrats, and I'd always tell him that he and my mom raised us to be good Christians, and that those values aligned most with the values on the left as I saw it. I was blessed to have my father for so long in my life, and I was lucky to have been able to have so many wonderful conversations with him. I'm also grateful that I thought to record this interview as a remembrance. And the fun part for you, the listener, is that he was a bit of a legend with an incredibly storied life, which very much comes across in this podcast.
It's good to see you.
Well, thank you, but tell me about your long hair. Isn't it longer than usual?
Well, I haven't been to a hairdresser since the pandemic started.
Okay, well, now here's the thing. I have a basketball game in an hour, so let's get started.
Well, let's go then. So that I restate.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I'm kind of exploring a couple of different topics. One of them is this idea that conservatives and liberals can't have reasonable conversations.
Right.
And then another one being that this notion that we're too far apart in our views to ever compromise on anything. And I think that that's wrong too. So one of the things, we donated to each other's candidates in 2008, which I always thought was a funny thing. It has come up recently when I was running for state party chair. People wanted to know why I had donated money to a Republican 12 years ago, or however long that was ago. And I didn't mention it, but at the time, you and I were both in the primaries, trying to get our candidates to the general election.
Yep.
And we were kind of supporting each other in that.
Yeah, that's
endeavor.
That's very good. Hey, something I just thought of.
Yeah.
You remember the very first time Biden ran for president?
I don't know if I remember the very first time, but I know he's run a couple of times.
He has. Well, the first time, it doesn't matter when it was. The point is, I sent him a check for $1,000 because he was a friend. He's from Delaware. And they asked me, are you really going to support him? I said, depends on who the Republicans put up. And there were a couple of crazy people. I said, if they put those up, I'm for Joe. If they put up a really strong, smart guy who cares about the country, I'll probably vote the other way. So I gave Joe $1,000.
All right. And so you do consider yourself a conservative Republican. Is that accurate?
Yes, I'm conservative, and there's no other place but Republicans for a conservative, so yes.
Okay, just making sure I'm being accurate.
I'm much more interested in several things that I don't see the Democrats. So China has been selling us $400 billion worth of stuff and putting it all in the military. They've, in the last, during the Obama administration, they built their Navy to be bigger and stronger than ours. And they have said, I've never heard a Democrat say this on MSNBC or anywhere. They said by the year 2025, they want to be the number one country in the world. And I did hear Obama say this. Well, somebody said that to him back then, and he said, well, let them be. It doesn't matter. Well, it does matter, because they will then capture the whole Southeast Asia
And okay. So that's one of the reasons you're a Republican.
Yeah, it's not about, you know, climate change or any of those kind of things. I'm all for it in a thoughtful
group. You're all for addressing climate change.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So one of the things I told you I wanted to talk about, your access to affordable health care, is a big issue on the left.
Yeah.
And I was unaware, when I had a business in Delaware, I bought into a small business pool.
Right. That
acted like, essentially, all the small businesses were like, in terms of that healthcare plan, one big corporation that could negotiate with hospitals and pharmaceuticals, et cetera, to get lower costs for their
money.
I was talking about that at one point in time and saying, why don't we do that nationally? You mentioned you helped pass that.
Yes, absolutely.
With John Burris, was it?
I can't remember, to be honest with you, who it was. I can't remember. But
I will double check that. But yeah.
But the thing is, there was no disagreement among, I forgot what they called the group of all the CEOs that worked together, but I was pushing it hard, and they all said, yeah, that would be great. Let's do it. Whether they were Democrats or Republicans. So that's the kind of common thing you can convince reasonable people to let's do it.
Okay. So would that be your notion of the best way to tackle healthcare, is individual pieces like that? Or do you see there to be some comprehensive thing we could do? And you don't have to say what you think a comprehensive thing is. I'm just curious if you think.
No, I'll tell you what I would. Everything I tell you is what I would do if I was president.
Okay.
So there's some big number, like 80 million people who are getting it through their companies. And the companies are all reducing the value of the benefit, which is okay. But I would not stop that. They've got their doctors, they've got everything set the way they want it. And I would not eliminate that. But then I would take something like Obamacare and just make it so it's not something so argumentative. And it's clear in my mind, there's a way to do that. But right now it's such a hot potato. Joe Biden said, we're going to go back and have Obamacare like it was. I never thought the idea of telling people they have to pay if they don't want the health care plan. Those things could be fixed up, Pinky, so easily. So you'd have an modified Obamacare. And Trump hated Obama so much, he wanted to get rid of it just to screw with Obama. But now, the Republicans came up with a good plan, and Paul Ryan, who was a libertarian, said, it's just like Obamacare, it's going to cost the country a lot of money. And yeah, it will, but it costs a lot more not to have it. So it's once again, and I'm delighted, skipping around, to hear that a group of Republicans and Democrats have gotten together in the Senate and come up with a $900 billion compromise. And it looks like Pelosi and the Trump are going to buy into it. It's very close. You know all about that?
You're talking about COVID relief stimulus?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, but the point is they're working together to do it because they've spent 3 or 4 months bitching with each other. So it's an example. That's all I'm saying.
Gotcha. So there is a possibility that people can work together.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I think the Democrats' strongest guy, and that is the West Virginia guy. You know what I'm talking about?
Joe Manchin?
Yeah.
Strongest guy how?
In trying to get to a cooperation and doing things together. I gather he was the lead horse talking with Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney hates Trump. And he criticized him all the time. So Romney and Joe Manchin apparently started it and kept adding other people. So that's the perfect example, Pinky.
Okay. And tell me about, you know, we've talked before, and I'll mention again, you worked with Hillary Clinton when she was trying to pass Hillary Care.
Yeah.
90s.
I was on the board of the Business Council, and I wasn't the president of it. It was another year or so later, but there was about four of us that went to Washington, to the White House, and sat with her. And we tried our best. And there was one guy there, I can't remember his name, who was very knowledgeable about all this. And he and I were doing most of the talking with Hillary, but we liked it. We liked it, but we said, Hillary, it'll never pass if you don't change A and B. She said, well, I can't do that. And we stayed there, I don't know, an hour and a half, 2 hours, trying to come up with ideas that would make it acceptable. And she never yielded. She didn't yield a minute. So yes, I worked with her, but was unsuccessful.
That experience and watching that experience happen in my mind was what made Obama address his healthcare plan the way he did, where liberals were very, or progressives or far left people were very upset with, they thought he had compromised too much up front.
Yeah, and then, I think you're right. I think he learned from that.
Yeah, I think that's kind of why he, and if you don't have that context of having seen Hillary fail by trying to stay firm and how she was doing it, you may not appreciate why Obama did that the way he did. But I always remember you telling me that y'all had tried to tell her the things that were gonna trip her up when she went in and tried to pass it, that you had tried to warn her about it and that she just wouldn't listen.
Yeah, and I'm not sure I'd want you to say that, but that, maybe you will, I don't really care, but it'll get people saying, well, he's a conservative and he's trying to screw Hillary. But it wasn't that at all. We had a very congenial discussion. But she had worked with some guy and a team, and they had convinced her that it had to be that way. So we just kept coming up, well, suppose you did this and suppose you did that. And she would say, well, I don't think the Democrats would go along with that. And so, yes, you said it simply, that we never could come with a compromise. Maybe it's a better way to say it than she wouldn't agree to change, but we tried.
Right. Well, and okay.
And that's what you're referring to. I mean,
so there's a sense in the country now, and look, maybe there are some people who are elected. I don't think the average Republican voter, and that's where I like to make a distinction, right? There are some people who are elected. You're kind of always trying to gauge where on the spectrum are they there for personal advancement or for public good? And they all kind of fall on the spectrum, right?
Correct.
And so it depends on where they fall in that spectrum as to how they'll vote. So there probably are some Republican elected officials who just have no interest in getting healthcare to people. But I don't believe the average Republican voter feels like, nah, there should just be people who don't have access to healthcare.
You're probably right. I think if there's many in the Congress, Republicans, there's not many who wouldn't like to have healthcare for everybody. But they always come up with something that requires somebody to pay for it instead of the government. And they've spent their whole career saying we got to balance the budget. And like I said, with Ryan Paul.
Rand Paul or Paul Ryan? Who are you talking about?
I'm talking about the Senator Ryan Paul.
Rand Paul.
Yeah. Talking about him. And he just kept saying, well, it's got the same problem Obama had. it's going to cost the government a tremendous amount of money. We're already owe so much. He's a libertarian. He's strong against anything that is it really expensive. But most of the Republicans were close to that plan, and he just kept convincing them we can't do that.
But yeah, I'm really questioning, though, you as a Republican voter.
Yeah.
And I'm asking you more to be the representative of Republican voters, which I know you can't, you're not monolithic, but as a Republican voter, what I'm saying is I don't think the average Republican voter wants to deny people health care. Is that?
I agree. No, I totally agree. Yeah.
You are around a lot of conservatives. I think, you know, you have friends who are conservatives. So, I mean,
sure.
I suspect you would have heard different from them.
I think everybody would like to have health care for everybody. I mean, I think most Republicans, it's back to the question of how do you do it without a huge price for the government? That's what the really conservatives, they don't want to spend money. And they can block things by just saying that. I think most of the Republican senators would love to do that because it would help them back in their home district. The reason they lost the House was health care. They said the Republicans don't want health care. And they were too stupid to go ahead and do something. I just thought of something else. Let's see if I can. Oh. Bob Dole?
Yeah.
So, in the last...
Did you talk to Bob Dole?
I talked to Bob Dole about something we could do in the climate change, and it was two of us. I don't remember exactly what the project was, but it was very close to being passed in the last section, last year of Clinton's first term. And I brought the waste management guy, CEO, and I was now the chairman of business council. And we stayed in there an hour with Bob Dole. And he's saying, we can do something like that when I get elected, but we're not going to do it now and give Clinton something to brag about. And he got so damn mad with me. Because he would say that, and I say, yeah, well, come on, Bob, it's about the country, or Senator Dole, it's about the country, it's about something very important, who knows who's going to win the election. And he said, I got to leave and go vote. And I said, sir, please don't, we got to keep talking about this, which was unbelievable. Maybe it wasn't a vote, he was just trying to get rid of me. But I saw him again later when he came to one of the business council's meeting, and they wanted me to sit beside him. And he said, no, he's on the wrong side. He remembered me. So that's an example. I was trying to work with Clinton. I was very close to Clinton, a lot of things, because as chairman of the business council, he was smart. He was likable. And I'll just advance forward. I talked with him about many different small things we could do in the whole, we weren't calling it climate change then, whatever it was.
Global warming.
Global warming, yeah. And he liked every one of them. Now I got the impression later after talking to him a lot, when you leave talking to Bill Clinton, you think he bought what you said and he's going to do it, but then he may or may not. But anyway, he said, I like it all, Ed. I'm going to ask Al Gore to get together a little committee and you bring your people. And so we had like four meetings with Al Gore in the White House, and Al would say, yeah, we can't do these two, but these two look very possible. So I'll get back with you shortly. And he never did. So the next meeting, I'd bring it up again. And he said, well, I wanted to do it. But, you know, when I got down to the people in the EPA or whatever they call it, they said it was too risky or too expensive or too something. And fundamentally, in the four meetings and maybe 10 or 12 ideas, they did two. That's my recollection.
So do you think that was just a product of bureaucratic problems or
yeah, no, bureaucratic.
Hitting up bureaucracy, not necessarily political will. Is that?
No, bureaucracy. Yeah. I mean, so there's two good points here. One is I was, for the first time, trying to work with Clinton and his team and Gore. I got to know Gore pretty well. And they said, well, when they talk to people, there's a big risk if you do that. Yeah, so it was the bureaucracy. And by the way, honey, it's changing the subject, but when you do these regulations, like Obama or Bush does a regulation, they don't have anything to do with the way it's written. Some person down the line who wasn't elected, who on both sides drafted what it's going to be. And it was tremendously tough on small businesses under Obama. And when people would talk to him, he would understand that. So it's your point. It's not just the difference between the leading people in the Democrat and the Republican Party, but it's the people down the line who make all the decisions, the specific decisions.
Tell me about, because we've talked about this before, the fluorocarbons that you wanted to phase out. Well, there was always talk of phasing out. I remember your face on a billboard at Greenpeace. Greenpeace put up a billboard with your face on it about destroying the environment.
Yeah, I can. I'm going to tell you a lot about that because it's so important.
Okay.
So, Dick Hickert was the chairman when some group of outstanding professors or technical or chemical people came to the conclusion that it was very harmful. I don't remember all the details.
The CFCs. You're talking about?
Yeah, CFCs. They call it Freon, remember?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
So DuPont, under Hickert was chairman and I was president, and we said, okay, we accept it for the first time, and we're going to come up with a substitute. We were already working on it. And yeah, because we knew the odds were that eventually we're going to have to get rid of it. So after Dick left and I became chairman, I got with all our people and say, what's the fastest we can do it? How much money would you have to spend to do it faster? Kind of like the vaccines they're doing now, do it fast. And they came back. So I got back with Gore and Trump, and I keep wanting to say Trump, Clinton was there. And I said, we can do this in 2 years. But remember, the environmental people are trying to make us do it immediately. And remember that hospitals have to have this. And clean rooms and businesses have to have this Freon. And people who live in Texas and Nevada, they can't drive airplanes in their house, their cars without it. So I want you to understand that we're going to be the leader. We're going to be the first one to do it. And we can do it in 2 years. So they both said, we agree with that. We understand it. We know you can't do it till you get the substitute, but it's not just a substitute. Everyone who uses Freon has to change. You can't just put it in the system they have now. They have to make modifications to the system because it works differently.
Right.
So I was proud and pleased when I went back and told people that, and we're leading the way. And so I put a team together just to add support to the work the scientists were doing, and kind of check in every month. They report back to me. So that was going great. And then the thing that I told you, Gore called me, said, "Ed, the car companies are calling like crazy. They said they've talked to you, and you told them you committed this to the government, and you can't change it." I said, "Well, what is it you want, Al?" I'm Vice President Gore. He said, "They want at least another year. They got to total rebuild their air conditioning system in the cars." And I said, "Well, you know, maybe, but maybe they're just saying that and they need to put more people on it." He said, "Whatever. President, I want you to delay it a year." And I think I said something smart ass like, "Well, I never thought a vice president of this country would call me up and say, 'Delay, something's going to improve the economy.'" He said, "Yeah, I know. I know, I'm ashamed." I mean, he was very nice. I went in his office one day, and he has in there a full-scale thing that I can't remember what you call it, of him. First thing you see is something life-size.
Like a cardboard cutout of him?
Yeah, yeah. So I still remember that. But anyway, we got along great. And then Clinton was going to give a speech in Washington on the subject. And we went to Florida. He asked me, would I come up? I said, sure. So I flew up there. And he gave his speech while they were doing all this. A lot of environmentalists in there. I thought he would call on me, but he never even said, "There's Ed Willard DuPont here in the audience," because he had his position set and he told him, and that's why it's got to be what it is. And he said, "I'm as anxious as you are, but we got to do this thing in a practical way." So after it was over, Gore came to me and said, "You want to come up and talk to the president?" I said, "No. I mean, you asked me to come up to answer questions, I assume." And he got through it very well. He explained it well. He was a great talker. So I never did talk to Trump, but I talked to Gore.
Clinton. But wait, you did fun diversion. You were at a Clinton birthday party in Jackson Hole, Wyoming,
yes.
Right?
Yes, yes.
Did you talk to him there about anything substantive or just?
Oh, no. No, I tell you who did. Peggy talked to Hillary. And we had just come back from China. And I noticed she was over talking to Hillary on a sofa for like an hour. And somehow she told Hillary, "We'd just come back from China." And Hillary said, "I'm getting ready to go. Tell me everything you think I need to know." So Peggy got along really well with Hillary. And then after everybody was leaving, we were invited to come spend 3 or 4 days at our friend's home. And when he said Clinton's coming, I said, "Well, we'll come later." He said, "No, I want you to be here." So we did. He came in. We had a cookout. And she was over talking to Hillary, and people were leaving, and everybody had been drinking. And Clinton and a Democratic senator, myself, and one of the other people were around the piano singing songs. So we all sang songs, and Clinton was very good at it. And so Peggy got through with Hillary, and they were ready to leave then. And you'll get a kick out of this, because this is your mother. We were standing there, and I shook his hand, so it was a great evening. Peggy had a good time with Hillary. And so he left me, and he was going to hug Peggy or shake her hand a lot. And she turned her back and walked away. she turned her back on the President of the United States.
Yes, that is my mother.
So let's see. There was one other thing I was going to say about it. Oh, this is huge. This is huge. So we did it, and the other companies were either not doing it and fighting it, or much slower. And on our board was, God, my memory is fading so bad. I know him like I know you. Anyway, Bronfman.
Edgar Bronfman,
yes. Who said, why do you let them call you Ed? Your name is Edgar. And my son's name, Edgar. So we had a board member, every time you saw him, he'd say to Bronfman, hey, Ed, how are you doing? Anyway, this is God's truth. Edgar Bronfman said to me, I know the head of Greenpeace very well. And he's willing to talk to you. I said, fine. I forgot we were in that Washington or wherever. And so I started by saying, I'm amazed you're willing to talk to me. You guys have put signs all over my town, community, saying, you know this guy? He's killing the environment. And I said, but it didn't work for you because people kept saying, I'm glad, I hope you get elected to something. They thought it was a good thing because they didn't read it carefully. Anyway, that meeting, I said, what is it you want? I said, we got it done. He said, I want you to help me get the rest of them, if they're fighting it, to stop, and if they're slow, to speed up. I said, of course, I'll be glad to talk to them and tell them they're making a huge mistake because they're fighting against the government. They're fighting against the scientific community. And I'll help them. I'll give them advice on how we're doing it. And he was very thankful. And I did it. He never called back to say it's going better. But I know each of them said, yeah, you're probably right. Because, you know, the head of DuPont is a big man in that community. And first they fuss with me for giving in so easily. But then they said, well, okay, you've done it, damn it. Now we got to do it.
So did you end up compromising on how fast you phased out the Freon CFCs, whatever, or did you go ahead and go at your timetable? Did you do what Gore wanted and slow down, or?
Oh, no, we did what Gore wanted. I mean, like I say, the automobile companies were already calling me and said, it's impossible. It's impossible. We didn't know you're going to be ready that fast, and we haven't modified our cars. I said, well, I'm sorry. I got to deal with Al Gore, and I'm going to do it, and you better do what we do, put a team on it and get ready. So I turned them all down. Well, three at least. That's all they call me. So when Gore called, he said, yeah, no fooling. They can't get ready. They say they can't get ready. So the president wanted me to ask you to delay a year.
One, two, or all the above. Was it just good business? Was it good for the environment? Was it outside pressure? What made you decide to move forward with phasing out CFCs?
Well, it's very simple. At DuPont, this sounds weird, but at DuPont, we always want to do things the right way. And we fought it, and we weren't going to change. I was the president. What's his name? Was the chairman. We got together with our science people, and he said, Dick Heckert said, are we going to have to do this or not? And they said, yes, you will be forced to do it. And we always wanted to be the leaders. We wanted to do, I mean, that's not right, wanting to be the leader. when our scientists said they'd carefully studied everything in that report and we needed to do it. And so you can say it's outside, but it's outside and not in a negative way. It's people who had just studied it in great detail for a year.
Scientific data.
Scientific data.
You were following the science.
We never fight scientific data. We never fight science. Whatever it is, if it's something to do with damaging the water or whatever. Now, I will confess that some DuPont plants and various things getting off freon were still doing things that were seeping things into the water. And when they got caught saying, oh, we didn't realize we had to pay. But we just said, if our scientific people say the scientific study was exactly right and it was causing harm, we got to do it. So we always wanted to do whatever was necessary. It doesn't matter what it was, if it was harmful. And if you go back and read my article, I want you to, in the book, I say when I took over, now remember he was there 2 years and I was president, so I was preparing what my thoughts were going to be. So I gave a talk in Europe a week after I'd been there and said, we are allowing too much bad stuff to come out of our plants. And we're going to change that. I don't like DuPont being considered one of the dirtiest companies as it was becoming. So I went on and on about, we're going to commit to 35% reduction in all those releases and then 60% in a certain period of time. And it was just, as I said, honestly, I don't believe our company and I don't believe our employees like seeing in the paper DuPont is releasing one of the top two or three in the country. And we can stop it, and we're going to. We just got to spend some money changing the way we do things. And we did it. We did it. We cut by 60% in 3 years. And in that case, after I didn't talk to the scientists on that. And after I said, we're going to cut it by 60%, they came to me and said, you can't do that. I said, no, I can't, but you can. Now go do it.
So tell me so there was a story you told me about there was a particular plant or something that you told them. Is that what you're referring to? In a more general term, but there's a specific story, right?
Oh, yeah. Much more general terms. Every plant.
Gotcha.
Every plant had to reduce, eliminate a certain amount of waste, noxins they're putting in the air. But the one plant was the one who were trying to trick me. Well, they were serious. They said, well, yeah, we can do it, but it'll cost $200 million. And I said, well, we're not going to spend that. So shut the plant down and buy it from a competitor. They seem to be able to do it. I don't care. But it was in Beaumont, Texas. And I said, we can't shut the plant down. We got people been there a long time. We got customers. I said, well, that's the problem. It's your problem. Shut the plant down or meet our target. And as I told you, they came back in about 3 or 4 weeks and said, we're starting over from scratch. We're going to run an entirely different chemical process because we couldn't modify what we had. And it will reduce the products we're releasing by 60%. And then they said, with a shameful face, and it's going to be cheaper than what we're doing. They said, we just need $15 million. I think that's in the book.
So $15 million to set up the new system, and then the production from that point on would be cheaper than their current production.
Exactly. You got it. Gotcha. So that was my favorite story of all time.
That's good. Well, I'll check that out in the book, and I'm conscious that we're getting up close to an hour, so I don't want to keep you longer. You mentioned the thing, and the Dark Waters story is starting to get a lot of play now for a lot of reasons, and not the least of which is because Biden's elected president, so there's a little more focus on DuPont. But I want to talk about that today. We can talk about that later because that might be a longer conversation than. But I do want to just ask.
Are you talking about the movie?
There is a movie, but the story, the situation that movie was based on has come out again because of someone Biden put in the person Biden put in charge of the EPA, or he's going to put in charge of the EPA. Aaron Brockovich has come out against.
Yeah.
And has written a piece that was in The Guardian about it. So that to me feels like it might be a longer story, but if you want to respond, you can.
Well, I will, because I don't know anything about it. I didn't go to the movie. I don't know which plants they were talking about. I don't know if we were guilty or not. I talked to the CEO and he said it was DuPont. Now he said it's very misleading.
All right.
In our part, he said,
You're not really aware of it. They claim there was some claim that they knew decades ago. So I don't have enough info on it to set it up for you to respond to. So I don't want to.
Well, I won't talk about it because a lot of people have asked me to talk about it, and I said I haven't studied it. I never heard a word about it when I was there.
Okay.
If it was going on, it's a shame, and we ought to have to pay for it. But I don't know. I don't know a thing about what they claim DuPont did. And right. I talked to Chad Holliday, who was the CEO too after me. And I said, Chad, and they interviewed him. And I said, people said that your interview wasn't very helpful, that you were not answering questions. And they said, it's all true. And Chad said, it's not true, Ed. It's not true. And yeah, I guess I was coached not to say a whole lot, but just to say, I'll look into it further. But so far, if we've done anything wrong, we'll correct it. So I've just elected not to learn about it. I don't, it just makes me sick.
Not your circus, not your monkeys anymore, as they say.
Yeah, right.
So the last thing I'll ask you, in a line with the kind of spirit of the conversation, and I didn't email this to you, but it's something that occurred to me this morning. A lot of conservatives are social conservatives, and I don't know that I would consider you that, but you know, I don't want to speak for you, but I do know, for instance, Billie Jean King has tweeted about you being her mentor.
Yeah.
She tweeted about that because there was a program about trying to get more women into this, you know, boardrooms and such like that. And so if men would mentor women, we've already got a lot of women mentoring women, but right. Men already have higher positions than a lot of women. So in order to get more mentors, you want more men mentoring women. But so I know she considers you a mentor and that you're friends and that you've worked together quite a bit. And, you know, she's a LGBTQ icon. So I was just curious if that ever was an issue between y'all.
No, absolutely not. Never came up. Sometimes I would kid them. You know, I forget there'd be certain things happen. I said, oh my God, y'all trying to take over the world or something like that, you know? But no, absolutely not. No, and Alana is, I'm even closer to Alana because she and I would occasionally have to slow Billie Jean down, you know, things she wanted to do. But that's an interesting story too, because, and then I'm going to go watch the ball game.
Yeah.
Many years ago, 10, 12, well, maybe 15. Billie Jean said, oh, God, I got so much going on and nobody to help me. And Peggy allegedly said, well, that'll help you. He just retired. He likes tennis. So I started helping her. And we made some progress on things. She was doing a lot of speeches, not getting paid for it, wearing herself out, traveling around the country. So we got a really make decisions on what we do and what we don't do. And the biggest thing I did for her, well, there were several really big ones, but this was the biggest. She came to Delaware because the Delaware Smash were playing that night.
Delaware Smash was the tennis team for a while, right?
Tennis team, yeah, for a number of years. She was laying on the bed and called me, and I went out there, and she said, "I'm so exhausted, Ed. I need some advice. I need some help." I said, "The best advice I can give you, and I want you to listen carefully, Alana loves you, and she does the things she can do for you. But every time I hear you talk about it, you're saying, I'm going to leave all this for Alana. Because Alana's about 10 years younger." I said, "That's not what she wants. She wants to be a part owner. If I was you, I'd give her a third. And she will bust her ass, not because of the money, because she wants to be, people in the tennis world know she's owner. It's Billy and Alana's world team tennis." She said, "Really?" Said, "She knows I'm going to leave it to her, and she'll hurry. She don't want to wait for you to die. You got to make her a partner." So she did end up giving her a quarter. And exactly true what I said. Billie Jean was now the proud owner. Alana was the proud owner of team tennis, not just Billie Jean King lead. And I did a number of things like that where she just didn't have any experience or common sense when we were
in the business world you're talking about.
In the business world. So she would tell people, I went to a talk she was giving, and she said, "Sitting in the pro is Ed Woolard, my mentor, and he helps me in every way." And so, yes, there was, no, the gay thing was never, ever an issue, even for a minute. Like I said, occasionally I'd say, "Well, kind of God, slow down a little bit." She said, "No, we got to do it. We got to do it now." And I said, "All right, go ahead."
It, just out of curiosity, do you think it should be legal for like Billie Jean and Alana to be married? But anything you care about, or?
Here's what I've thought all along, and I guess the answer is yes. But
you think it should be legal?
Yes, legal. 10 years ago, I thought they should come up with another term. I mean, I read the Bible quite often, Pinky, and I'm very thankful to God and Jesus for the life I've led. Unbelievable. Started work at DuPont by knocking on the door. Was told repeatedly every time I got promoted, that's as far as I could go if I could do that well. And I said, I love the company. I'll stay here in this job forever. And having Peggy with me for 64 years, we've both been healthy till the last year. And you and Annette coming along and never giving us any trouble like people hear and say about their kids. How do I put together and accept that what the Bible says? And I'll give you my answer. Jesus never said that. I read it over and over and over. Jesus never said it. It was said in the Old Testament. And Paul, St. Paul, who was a wonderful guy and did so much because his job was to move from the Jews to the Gentiles, which is all of us, and tell them Jesus is there for you too. And he just traveled all over the world starting churches. And unbelievable what he did. But he's the one that said, it's against God's wishes. Only man and woman should marry. So I've comforted myself by saying, Jesus had plenty of chances to do it, and he never said that. And, you know, St. Paul was supposed to just say things that he had heard from above, but he said several things that were unnecessary. So I don't think by supporting them in marriage that I'm violating my beliefs with God and Jesus.
Okay. All right. Well, there you go.
There you go.
I know you have a ball game to get to, so I don't want to keep you, and I appreciate your taking this much time to speak to me. I hope we'll get to do it again.
Well, I don't know that I know much more, but we can talk on anything you want to, because yeah. I love you, and I'm sorry we don't get to see you more often, and I'm very pleased with all you've done. I want you to slow down and not keep just going on something new, but you won't do it, and that's smooth. I guess that's me too. Okay, honey, love you. I'm thrilled that you're working on all this, and I've given you some pretty good information, particularly during the Clinton series, because yep. This is off the subject, but we always went to Washington, all the 100 CEOs, and I asked him one time, why don't you come to Williamsburg when we're having our annual meeting? He said, okay. So he came. That's the only time he ever went out of Washington to meet with the business council. And I was walking in with him to introduce him. And it was going to be, who's the head of the World Bank? And I said, I know you got five people, but this is the best one. You ought to take him. And he did. I don't know that had much to do with it, but he did. All right, honey.
I love you. Thank you. And we'll talk soon. Enjoy your game.
Well, it's early in the season, but I want to see him.
We'll do it to it.
Okay. Bye-bye. Right.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Louisiana Lefty. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Thank you to Ben Collinsworth for producing Louisiana Lefty, Jen Pack of Black Cat Studios for our Super Lefty artwork, and Thousand Dollar Car for allowing us to use their Swamp Pop Classic Security Guard as our Louisiana Lefty theme song.